This is KBOO Portland, Volunteer Powered Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's Loud and Proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, it's the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On today's program, we're proud to present the latest headlines from the Electronic Intifada with host Nora Barrows Friedman. Then on today's show, we return to Haiti and yet another clandestine interview from the heart of its gang-occupied capital to discuss the reasons behind their stalemate with the Haitian police. Then we turn our attention to Trump's gunboat diplomacy in Venezuela, where the government is reported to have mobilized 4.5 million citizens into militias to defend the territory. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up first on the program, we're proud to present the latest headlines from the Electronic Intifada with host and producer Nora Barrows Friedman.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 693 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has killed at least 475 Palestinians and injured nearly 2,200 between August 20th and August 27th, according to official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. The Israeli army has continued to destroy entire city blocks in Gaza City and other areas in northern Gaza in relentless bombing and demolition operations across the south, east, and north of the city, advancing from three axes toward the city's center in a campaign of comprehensive destruction and systematic erasure, according to Euromed Human Rights Monitor. This escalation marks a new phase of the genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, ongoing for 23 months, Euromed says. Quote, this assault follows the Israeli army's official announcement of Operation Gideon's Chariots 2 on August 20th, with its preliminary and initial stages already underway. Over 1 million people are now trapped in less than 30% of Gaza City, all facing the threat of forced displacement to the south, under a plan designed to erase the city, inflict systematic destruction, and establish full military control. Israel has been using bomb-carrying drones, as well as remote-controlled armored vehicles packed with tons of explosives, to obliterate residential buildings and homes. Footage of a lethal quadcopter drone was recorded by civil defense worker Mahmoud Salem east of the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood in Gaza City. Euromed added that, quote, the continued excessive intensity of Israeli attacks, combined with the limited capacity and accessibility of the few functioning hospitals and the absence of basic civil defense capabilities and field coverage, makes accurate documentation of casualties impossible. The actual death toll is almost certainly far higher than what has been announced or recorded to date, they say. These practices are inflicting catastrophic and irreversible consequences on hundreds of thousands of civilians already enduring starvation and displacement. They are subjected to daily bombings and killings as their city is erased block by block before their eyes, while the international community remains inactive and silent in the face of one of the most heinous crimes of genocide in modern history, the rights group adds. Alam Hejazi filmed footage of the complete destruction of Al-Istijaba Mosque in Asabra neighborhood, one of the most crowded areas in southern Gaza City. Attacks this week were carried out on the tents of displaced Palestinian families, including in the Al-Mawasi area in western Gaza. An attack on Tuesday, August 26th, on tent shelters in Al-Mawasi killed a young girl, Juri Lafi. A few days before, on August 23rd, Al-Mawasi tent shelters were also bombed. Journalist Ahmed Al-Najjar reported that 17 displaced Palestinians, including 6 children, were slaughtered by Israel's bombing of makeshift tents at dawn, areas that the Israeli army has previously designated as so-called safe zones, but as routinely bombed and attacked. On Monday, August 25th, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, Israel bombed the Nasser Medical Complex in a so-called double-tap strike, killing at least 22 people, including rescue workers and 5 journalists. The strikes targeted the 4th floor of the emergency building, first killing Reuters cameraman Hussam El-Masri and at least one other civilian, as rescue workers searched for survivors, and as journalists documented the aftermath of al-Masri's assassination, Israel targeted the area again, killing and wounding the civil defense workers and 4 other journalists. The attack was captured live on video by journalists filming across the street.
راح الدفاع المدني كتلوا الناس استهداف كبير الآن كما تشاهدون في هذه الصورة تدمير كبير قصف عنيف جدا
In addition to Hussam al-Masri, Israel assassinated Mohammed Salama, an Al Jazeera photographer and reporter for Middle East Eye, Mariam Abu Dakka, a journalist working with the Independent Arabic and the Associated Press, Moaz Abu Taha, a freelance journalist, and Ahmed Abu Aziz, a freelancer who also worked with Middle East Eye. Civil defense firefighter Abdullah al-Sha'ir and other civilians were also killed. At least 10 others, including journalists and civil defense workers, were injured. Euromed Human Rights Monitor's field team, quote, reported seeing an Israeli surveillance drone flying at low altitude over Nasser Medical Complex before the attack, providing further evidence that it was deliberate and intelligence-guided, with precise information collected about the site and the victims. The Palestinian civil defense stated after the attack that, quote, this Israeli targeting of our crews was not the first during the ongoing war of extermination. Today marks the 26th time our crews have been targeted in the field of humanitarian work, and the 11th time our crews have been targeted inside their centers and workplaces. By committing this crime, the civil defense added, the occupation forces have rendered the only 2 rescue and ambulance vehicles in Khan Yunis Governorate out of service after they were damaged in this bombing. Only the sole fire engine remains in service. With this bombing, the total number of civil defense martyrs has risen to 139 and 343 wounded since the beginning of the war of extermination that the occupation continues to perpetrate against our people in the Gaza Strip. Israel's prime minister and war crimes suspect Benjamin Netanyahu claimed in English on social media that the attack was a, quote, mishap, and that, quote, Israel values the work of journalists, medical staff, and all civilians. But in Hebrew language media, which is not a secret language and can be easily translated into English, Israeli soldiers admitted that the strikes were, quote, approved and coordinated with senior command. Soldiers from the Golani unit of the Israeli army demanded an apology from Netanyahu, saying that his apology was insulting and dangerous to their unit commander. The Israeli army also claimed that it was targeting a camera supposedly belonging to resistance fighters. The Gaza government media office repudiated the claim, saying on August 26th that, quote, this camera was clearly visible. It belonged to Reuters photojournalist Hussam al-Masri, who was killed by the occupation in the first raid while he was broadcasting live to the media. Targeting journalists is strictly prohibited under international humanitarian law and constitutes a documented war crime. The media office said that Israel's attempt to craft this false narrative, quote, is merely an extension of an old approach followed in every crime, fabricating pretexts and evidence to evade international prosecution. Its repeated accusations of military activities against hospitals and civilian infrastructure are intended to legitimize their bombing, a complete violation of all international laws. Furthermore, throughout the genocidal war, it has failed to prove its claims and lies that hospitals or civilian infrastructure are linked to military activities. Middle East Eye reported that U.S. contractors at a Gaza Humanitarian Foundation site had detained and interrogated a source of Mohammed Salama, seeking information about the reporter's identity and whereabouts before he was killed in the Khan Yunis bombing at Nasser Medical Complex. The U.S. mercenaries reportedly asked about a specific story that Middle East Eye says Salama worked on anonymously for security reasons. Colleagues of the murdered journalists condemned the way that the Associated Press and Reuters reported on the attacks that killed them, once again giving Israel's claims the benefit of the doubt while not standing behind their employees. Al Jazeera's Hind Khodari said on Tuesday that, quote, the Reuters news agency did not mention in their headline their cameraman, who had been working for them for months. In their article, they simply described him as a Reuters contractor. Another journalist was killed in Khan Yunis just hours after the attack on Nasser Medical Complex, bringing the total number of reporters assassinated by Israel on August 25th to six. Israeli forces killed Hassan Duhan, a journalist and academic who worked as a correspondent for the publication Al-Hayat Al-Jadida. The Gaza government media office said that he was shot by Israeli forces in Al-Mawasi. And on Saturday, August 23rd, Khaled al-Madhoun, who worked as a photojournalist for Palestine TV, was killed by direct fire while working in northern Gaza. 246 journalists and media workers have now been killed by Israel since October 2023. Mariam Abu Dakka, the photojournalist who was killed at Nasser Medical Complex, wrote a letter to her son Gheith to be published on the occasion of her death. Abu Dakka wrote, quote, Gheith, you are your mother's heart and soul. I want you to pray for me and not cry over me so I can remain happy. I want you to make me proud, to succeed, to excel, to stand strong, and to become a capable businessman, my love. I want you, my dear, never to forget me. I always did everything to make you happy, to keep you joyful and comfortable, and to give you everything. When you grow up, get married and have a daughter, name her Mariam after me. You are my love, my heart, my support, my soul, and my son, who always makes me proud and brings me joy with his good reputation. I entrust you, Gheith, to your prayers, your prayers, your prayers, my dear, your mother, Mariam. Mohammed Assad, a photojournalist and longtime contributor to the Electronic Intifada, appealed to the world to stop Israel's genocide and serial attacks against journalists.
This is the last call from Gaza City for all foreign journalists in the world. Please come to Gaza and start covering with us. We don't have any protection. 245 Palestinian journalists killed at the moment. Please come to us and compress in your governments in everywhere and come to Gaza. We don't have any protection. We don't have gasoline in our cars. We have expired vests and wear it. Come to us before the occupation invasion Gaza City. In the next month, they will destroy everything here. It will be a lot of mass cries in this place.
That was Mohammed Assad, a photojournalist and longtime contributor to the Electronic Intifada. And in related news, Valerie Zink, a writer and photographer who worked for Reuters in Canada, announced hours after the attack on Nasser Medical Complex that she was resigning from her position as a stringer from the news agency in protest of its role, as she says, quote, in justifying and enabling the systematic assassination of 245 journalists in Gaza. I owe my colleagues in Palestine at least this much and so much more. Zink writes, quote, Reuters' willingness to perpetuate Israel's propaganda has not spared their own reporters from Israel's genocide. Western media is directly culpable for creating the conditions in which this can happen, she adds. I have valued the work that I brought to Reuters over the past 8 years, but at this point I can't conceive of wearing this press pass with anything but deep shame and grief. I don't know what it means to begin to honor the courage and sacrifice of the journalists in Gaza, the bravest and best to ever live. But going forward, I will direct whatever contributions I have to offer with that front of mind. That was from photographer Valerie Zink. As Israel's mass destruction of Gaza City accelerates, so does its policy of forced expulsion. Al Jazeera's Hind Khodari said that Israeli forces have been intensifying their airstrikes and quadcopter attacks on Jabalia, north of Gaza City, forcing Palestinians to move. This week, Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their homes in the Saftawi neighborhood of northern Gaza City following repeated threats and attacks by Israeli forces. The United Nations Humanitarian Office warned on Wednesday that there are simply not enough shelter materials for people who are being displaced. Quote, multiple organizations' attempts to bring shelters into the Strip are being rejected by the Israeli authorities, even before the supplies are brought into Israel or the occupied Palestinian territory. Partners stress that many tents and tarpaulins have worn out and must urgently be replaced. In addition, high tides overnight have submerged tents on the beach, affecting at least 200 families. Partners also underscore that tents and other shelter equipment must be allowed into all parts of Gaza, including directly to northern Gaza and Gaza City. The Gaza government media office stated on August 24th that the shelter deficit exceeds 96%, leading it to determine that the southern governorates of the Gaza Strip are unable to accommodate 1.3 million forcibly displaced people as Israel exacerbates the humanitarian catastrophe. At the same time, the media office added, quote, there are no safe spaces for displacement in the southern Gaza Strip, as the Israeli occupation army imposes military control over approximately 77% of the Strip's area, making any new displacement nearly impossible and threatening the lives of the displaced. Meanwhile, children and adults are continuing to die of starvation. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, the international body that monitors malnutrition and starvation, formally determined that Stage 5 famine, the final and most catastrophic stage, is currently unfolding in Gaza. Quote, as this famine is entirely man-made, it can be halted and reversed, the IPC stated. The time for debate and hesitation has passed. Starvation is present and is rapidly spreading. There should be no doubt in anyone's mind that an immediate at-scale response is needed. Any further delay, even by days, will result in a totally unacceptable escalation of famine-related mortality. According to the Famine Review Committee, all three criteria for declaring famine have been met. At least 20% of households face extreme lack of food, At least 30% of children suffer from acute malnutrition, and at least 2 out of every 10,000 people die daily from starvation. The Palestinian group Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights stated that, quote, the current state of starvation and famine was driven by the consistent destruction of food sources, including farmland, agricultural production sites, and the fishing industry, as well as water sources and infrastructure. While this declaration by the IPC is significant and welcomed, Al-Mizan stresses that it must be followed by concrete action from the international community to end famine, starvation, and every other genocidal act that is being carried out by Israel against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Famine has long been rampant in Gaza, and today's declaration only confirms what Al-Mizan has long warned of. Save the Children International's CEO Inger Ashing spoke at the United Nations Security Council this week, saying that clinics in Gaza, quote, are overwhelmed by need, every bench packed with malnourished children and their mothers, yet our clinics are almost silent now. Children do not have the strength to speak or even cry out in agony. They lie there emaciated, quite literally wasting away, their tiny bodies overcome by hunger and disease, the medical and specialized nutrition supplies they need all but used up, she said. A few kilometers away stand ready a sea of supplies, thousands upon thousands of truckloads of life-saving items, all blocked, she said. These past few weeks, more and more children have shared that they wish to be dead. One child wrote, I wish I were in heaven where my mother is. In heaven, there is love, there is food and water. According to official records from the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza, as of August 27th, 313 deaths by starvation, including 119 children, have now been documented since October 2023. This includes 248 deaths since July 1st, 2025, of whom 58 were children and 10 people who died on August 27th alone. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces launched 2 massive incursions into Nablus and Ramallah this week as settlers continue to destroy and seize Palestinian agricultural land. On Wednesday, August 27th, nearly 80 Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and tear gas during an Israeli raid into the old city of Nablus. Wafa News Agency said the invasion lasted for nearly 14 hours, resulting in 2 detentions and forcing several families to leave their homes, which were then converted into military observation posts. A child was blindfolded and abducted by Israeli soldiers during the invasion. According to local and security sources, dozens of military vehicles raided the city and deployed their troops in its center, placing the old city under siege and conducting a wide-scale invasion campaign. Nearby in Sebastia, also in the northern West Bank, Israeli forces swarmed the village on Tuesday, raiding Palestinian homes and destroying their contents. Israeli soldiers also assaulted residents, ransacked shops, and stole money and goods from them. Sebastia's mayor, Mohammed Azam, told the New Arab that the invasion operation began at the ancient town's archaeological site, where troops expelled shopkeepers and closed tourism kiosks before expanding into the old city. Snipers were deployed on rooftops, dozens of homes were raided, and residents were interrogated in the streets. In the last 5 months, Azam said, Israel has been engaged in intense excavations and digging, and antiquities have been stolen. In May, Israel's parliament approved a multi-million dollar proposal to turn Sebastia into a Zionist tourist destination, using pseudo-archaeological pretexts and biblical mythology in an attempt to seize the land, with plans to place the site under its so-called antiquities authority and build a military watchtower there. Israeli forces launched a raid on Ramallah and nearby Albireh on Tuesday, wounding nearly 60 Palestinians, including a child who was shot in the abdomen. Al Jazeera reported that Israeli snipers positioned themselves on rooftops and soldiers stormed the central vegetable market area, while others fired stun grenades into busy shops. No! was in Ramallah earlier this week. Israeli soldiers also raided a currency exchange shop in downtown Ramallah, stealing 1.5 million shekels, or about $450,000, claiming the cash was being used to fund Hamas. Near Ramallah, Israeli forces uprooted approximately 3,000 olive trees in the village of Al-Mughayr this week. The army said that the trees posed a security threat to a main road to an Israeli settlement colony that runs through the village's lands. The deputy head of the village council, Marzouk Abu Naim, told the Wafa news agency that Israeli soldiers had stormed more than 30 homes since dawn on August 23rd, destroying residents' property and vehicles. Israeli settlers also attacked olive tree groves. Palestinian farmers in the Ramallah area, including in Al-Mughayr village, replanted trees that had been uprooted and destroyed by Israeli soldiers and settlers. Wafa news agency reported that hundreds of residents were forced to spend the night in neighboring villages due to the brutal assault on the village and the Israeli-imposed ban on entering or leaving. Last week, Israeli forces closed the two main entrances to the village, preventing entry or exit, including ambulances, while forcing shop owners to shut down and restricting the movement of residents inside the village. Settlers also threatened residents by calling their mobile phones, vowing to kill them and destroy their property. Last year, extremist Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir set up his tent at the eastern entrance to Al-Mughayr, inciting against the village and demanding the displacement of its residents and the demolition and bulldozing of all houses and lands, Wafa added. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Journalists Denounce Israel's Attempts to Silence the Truth by Ohud Nassar, writing from Gaza City. Ohud writes about Israel's targeted assassinations in a suicide drone strike of a group of journalists inside the Al Jazeera tent next to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City on August 10th. The attack came after the Israeli military made repeated threats against Al Jazeera correspondents Anas Al-Sharif and Mohammed Kureika, who were killed alongside two colleagues, Ibrahim Zahir and Mohammed Nufal, both camera operators. Three other people who were present were also killed: freelance journalist Mohammed Al-Khaldi, Mo'amen Aliawa, and Saad Jundia, a civilian who happened to be present. Ohud talked to two other journalists, Wadi Abu Al-Sud, a reporter with Yemen TV, and Saeed Hasballah, a freelance cameraman with Al Jazeera, who witnessed the attack. She writes, quote, "Both Al-Sud and Hasballah said that they were in shock after witnessing their friends die in front of them, powerless to save them. It was only 3 hours later I realized I had shrapnel in my back," Al-Sud said. "Seeing Anas and Mohammed like that, my nerves collapsed. I didn't even notice my own wounds. Anas and Mohammed were not just colleagues, they were my brothers. My wife has been suffering from a serious illness with no medicine available in Gaza for a week, and both of them had been helping me search for medicine." Hasballah spoke of his bond with Mohammed Kureika. "Since the second Israeli invasion of Al-Shifa Hospital in April of last year, they endured siege together. Al-Sud had stood by Mohammed and supported him when Mohammed's mother was killed during the invasion of Al-Shifa. She had gone missing and was found in the street where Mohammed had to eventually identify his mother's corpse by the way she slept, her nails, and her hair. Still, there is no action from international bodies, and still Israel kills journalists. Nonetheless, journalists in Gaza remain undeterred." Baida Mo'amer, a TV presenter with Palestine TV, told the Electronic Intifada, "The language of humanity is our shared language, and we have sworn to deliver the message, even if only one journalist remains alive." Those are excerpts from Journalists Denounce Israel's Attempts to Silence the Truth by Ohud Nassar, a student in education studies writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine. journalist Mohammed Al-Sha'ir, filmed a group of kids playing on the beach, jumping into the waves and cheering each other on, he says, just a few meters away from the Israeli army's position on the shores of Rafah. Quote, in the place closest to danger, they carve out a space of peace. And in the face of death, they carry nothing but hearts beating with life and innocence. That's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
Attention back to Haiti, where tension is mounting for many reasons internally, because the police continue to lose the battle against the gangs. The government is losing credibility daily from the majority of the population. And a U.S. flotilla of ships off the shore of Venezuela is not making anyone calmer. There is some speculation that it's an easy pivot from Venezuela to Haiti, given the situation. Now joining us is a clandestine visitor from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, welcome back. And please don't say your name or any indication of where you are.
Yes, Clevin, glad to be with you and share, you know, any information that you would like to know about how views on the situation in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Well, let's just start with that then. Let's talk about this sort of back and forth that continues between the police and the gang coalition known as Vive Ensemble. We know that even the Trump administration, what was it, a couple weeks ago, issued a $5 million warrant for the arrest of Jimmy Cherizaire, also known as Barbecue, former policeman, who is the de facto porte-parole, the spokesperson for the Vive Ensemble terrorist gang coalition. How do you view all of that? Are people taking this seriously? I mean, as if the FBI doesn't already know where Jimmy Cherizaire is in Haiti?
Anyway, people think that there's a hidden message by this because normally when they put a Lamour Saint-Jean, that's the head of the gang Katsan that they called Katsan Marozo, and also Vitelom.
Just a second. Katsan Marozo were the ones who were responsible for kidnapping those 17 American and Canadian missionaries a year back.
So when that occurred, you know, normally it was like the part of the government, you know, to hand those from police operations and to hand them over to the U.S. But now that they have declared Vive Ensemble and Grand Grief as international terrorist organization, so I think that normally if they had a particular interest in getting the head, the port power of Vive Ensemble, so they had jurisdiction to pick him up. So we don't know, but it's still a little bit confusing because from our point, it's not clear the real agenda that they have for the gangs. And you know, speculations are going around. There's not a common position of the most of the people and most of the journal and the news. Everybody is having their own view on what's going on, and on the possible goal of the U.S. of the current U.S. administration toward resolving this issue with the gangs back in Port-au-Prince.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of my guest today, coming to you from the heart of Port-au-Prince, Haiti, which we are told is, you know, went from 80% to 85% to 90% to, you know, the number, the percentage of the capital that is now in the hands of gangs keeps raising. And, you know, I've heard folks say that with every percentage that's raised, the Haitian government receives more international funding. So what are they using all this international funding for if not to defeat Vive Ensemble? And what on earth are the police doing today? They seem to like be in this cat and mouse game where the gangs come in, they attack, they take over a territory. Then suddenly we see these press releases from the police, you know, what do they call them? Opération Musculaire, right? Right, they have these words that they use, you know, muscular operation against the gangs, and you hear that maybe two or three may have been killed, and but they, you know, or maybe that you hear that 12 were killed, but they only got two guns. Help us to understand these kinds of reports that we're hearing. You know, first of all, you know, the incredible amount of money that's going into the so-called CPT and the government of the Prime Minister Didier Fizamé. And then, of course, what is going on with the police and their inability to really take these guys on?
In fact, it's because there's what I personally think is a question of, let's say, conflict of interest. Okay? So, because so many on the political side, they have one common goal: to stay as long as possible, since they reach the power, you know, of the position that they are currently in, so they want to stay. and they want to profit, you know, they want to get the maximum profit that they can from the current position that they have, and they want to stay as long as they come. So this is why they are not going to be doing something to quickly resolve the situation. So they are going to be going slowly, you know. It's like to maintain the situation so they could still be in power, they could still see how they could control future eventual election. So that's one of the point, if you look at it that way, that they are not completely engaged, you know. The other side of the conflict and threats, it's not some of them has tie with the gang, and we've learned it, we've known, and it's been documented that previous government, when they want, for instance, to there's an event and they wanna to go through, they have to pay gangs, you know. If they have gangs that were, by then, you know, they were two separate groups, so they had to feed all of them, you know, if they want to make a special event in an area that the gangs control. So this is to tell you that they have relation with the gangs, you know. And on the political side, they've been using them to, you know, to gain territories, to gain area, you know, for election. So they are not unified, you know, on the gangs that they want, because since they are nine, each of them has their tie, and which is
nine. Yes? Presidential counselors of the CPT. That's what you were referring to, because people might have thought you meant nine gang leaders, but nine presidential.
No. Right. Yeah, the nine members of the CPT. Okay. So it's for their own political and financial interest. And since this it's not common, you know, they are not tied to the same gang. They are not tied to the same people family in the oligarch family that are in control of them. So this is why they cannot set up a plan, you know, a perfect plan to deal with that. You know, it's basically it's a question of conflict of interest.
Well, it actually sounds like business as usual, right? I mean, that's been, except for maybe the two administrations of Aristide, that's pretty much describes most of the Haitian government since, you know, between the 1991 coup and the 2004 coup and after the 2004 coup. But what I hear you saying is that these guys have so many conflicts of interest. Well, the most important point is that what you're saying is that they have no incentive to resolve the crisis, because the longer it stretches out, the more money they can make, the more people they can put on the payroll, the more sort of political favors they can call from people, right?
Exactly.
So that's pretty cynical.
That's why they can have a unified plan, you know. It's special. Basically, is that you will be finding other reason, but I think the mandatory reason is the conflict of interest. This is why they don't stand, you know, as one and to have a particular plan, you know, because they don't agree. If they agree that they're going to target this one, a few of them want to start, you know, they are not thinking it in a strategic way, you know, in a logical way. They are thinking through their interest, and they have, you know, diverse, you know, opposite interest, you know, in some point.
There's a lot of suffering. You know, over a million people have been displaced from their homes. There's still 1.5 million living in the gang areas, and often those people living in those areas will be targeted by the police for assassination, or they could be targeted by the gangs for repression. Are people suffering, and why would the CPT ignore that suffering? I mean, are you really saying that they're so cynical that they would rather put more money in their pocket than end the suffering of those people at the hands of the gangs in Haiti?
Yes, this is the right let's say word to use. They are cynical, you know, at that point, because their view is if they don't do it that way, others will come and go. It's like there's a they are also going through a hidden agenda. So when they look at it, they see, you know, it's only the way to go is to take care of themselves, because it's gonna be difficult for them to resolve the issue. So they put it apart. They're trying to, you know, to lower it, you know, when things are increasing, and they forget about the population. But I also have to tell you that there's a minor, but it is still a strategic way change that it's starting to be operating, you know, this week. It's because the head of Vivre Ensemble, he tried to discuss a peace agreement with the area of the people living in Nazan area, in Solino, and also Criswa, because in most of this area the people were displaced. They burned their houses, you know, they had to flee for their life, and they are now living in camps on which it is difficult for them to find water, to be fed, and there's violence, you know, with all these people together. Young kids are getting rape, you know, and all these issues. So the prime minister is planning on was invited to Washington this week.
To Washington.
It's for the OAS proposition.
Yeah, the OAS has proposed a so-called roadmap, which includes $2.6 billion.
But what's happening currently now? Since the head of Vivre Ensemble is seeing the possibility that things are not changed, now he wants those people to come back. And he negotiated with some leaders, and some of those leaders are police officers that live in the neighborhood, for the people to get back. So some of them, a few of them, started to get back. The police that are protecting, and the gang, the police that are protecting Criswa, they don't want to be a part of it. But those from Solino and Nazon, they are getting back. And when they are getting back, what they are observing, you know, they are coming in an area where they cannot, you know, they would need to repair, because house are burned, everything is destroyed. You know, so even if they back down, you know, because they say that they will retreat their troop from this area, so those people can come, you know, from the place that they were, you know, displaced, the camp where they are to go and live back on their neighborhood. But once they get there, it's no longer a place where they can live.
There's nothing there.
There's nothing there. They burn. I personally have a friend that sent me video, you know, of his house. You see, for him, and it's all like that in the whole, it's the entire neighborhood. And it's gonna, you know, in order to repair this area, it's gonna take a lot of time, because they burn
and
they
money
destroy and everything that was left. So you cannot from one day to another move and go back. You know, it's not even feasible. But it seems that they are doing that in order to, since this, it seems that they might have special operations from the Vivre Ensemble, particularly targeted by Delma, you know, down Delma. So they want people to come in this area, so it will be more difficult, you know, for the police or the mission to make the operation. And if they do, they would have, you know, collateral damages.
They become de facto human shields at that point for the gangs.
Exactly. And there's a small progress, but I don't know, that they made in Kinskov, where a group from they were controlling telecommunication facilities in NatCom, you know, in a mountain that in Kinskov area, you know, and they made an operation. The police and the MSS, they make an operation I guess it was on at the beginning of this week or Sunday. I have to double check for you, but from 1 a.m. to 4, and they show the, you know, that they killed some gang members, and they make a press conference jointly with the Police Nationale and the Port Powell of the speak person for
the MSS. Yeah.
Yeah, they showed, this is the rare time that they show what they were able to, you know, how many people that they arrest, how many that they killed, you know, so they could get access to this area. But in between, the U.S. administration is from what I'm hearing on the news, is considering another country instead of Kenya, you know, for this mission. So I don't know if it's, you know, what motivated them to do this jointly operation and show and finally providing some results.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Again, that's the voice of my guest. Clandestine interview from the heart of gang-occupied Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome, Kevin. Anytime.
All right, I think we're going to take a short break here. And when we get back, we're going to discuss what's going on in Venezuela with Dan Kovalik. Stay tuned for that and more here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And you are still listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for Dennis Bernstein. Well, we're going to turn our attention to Venezuela, where we're seeing U.S. gunboat diplomacy in action by the Trump administration. Joining us to talk about this today is our dear guest, Daniel Kovalik. He's an American human rights, labor rights lawyer and political activist. He previously taught international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. He is also the author of the book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, listen, I'm having a little bit of cognitive dissonance because I've been watching the news and particularly what's been coming out of Telesur and what's been coming out of the Latin American news agencies. And what I've seen is that Maduro and the PSUV government have been very successful at enlisting 4.5 million Venezuelans in a militia on top of the military they already have. So what on God's good earth does Trump expect to achieve here by sending these gunboats?
Well, I think what he hoped to achieve was some sort of regime change. You know, in combination with the economic sanctions against Venezuela, which are still, you know, really detrimental to the economy and to the ability of people to get, you know, basic necessities, I think Trump thought that, hey, if we have this military show of force, that maybe it could lead to some sort of revolt against the government. Now, as you say, it appears the opposite has happened. The people are rallying around the government, as you said, joining militias by the thousands, if not millions. And so, you know, the question is, what does Trump do in response to that? If he realizes, okay, they're not going to be intimidated.
Right. Well, it seems to me that, and by the way, that 4.5 million figure was the figure that's being bandied around in the Latin American press. 4.5 million people enlisted in the militias to defend Venezuelan integrity and sovereignty. I didn't make that number up, just so people are clear.
But, yeah, no, I saw that. I did see that figure, and I believe it. I believe it to be, you know, accurate.
Well, that's a lot of people. And so that means, I mean, if this were a realistic military invasion, and we'll get into the pretext a little bit later, it would mean that literally the U.S. would have to commit genocide at that point. And, of course, there's been a precedence with Israel, so why the heck not, right? I mean...
Yeah, although, you know, the thing that's happening, of course, in Gaza is the last figure I saw is that 83% of the people being killed are civilians, right? Mostly women and children. In this case, they'd have to fight, you know, millions of armed Venezuelans, right? So the U.S. doesn't like to fight forces that it can't just defeat within, you know, days. So I don't think they would want to meet that kind of force because, well, you're right. To win, they'd have to commit genocide, but also in the meantime, there'd be a lot of American casualties, which, of course, the U.S. is quite averse to. So I don't see it as a realistic possibility that they're actually going to land on shore and try to meet the Venezuelan people in combat. I don't think that's going to happen. Again, I think this is a show of force to try to intimidate the country. Again, maybe they thought to spur on some sort of counter-revolution, but I, you know, if they're smart at all, they're going to see that that's not happening.
Well, it's interesting because many of my friends in Haiti, you know, it's about drug cartels. That's what Trump says, right? That Maduro is the leader of drug cartels, that he's involved with the Colombian cartels. But we know that the drug cartels are working with the gangs that have taken over large swaths, 90%, they say, of the capital of Haiti, and that Trump has recently made noise that he's going to do something about it. How unrealistic is that, in fact, this might be a deflection and that it's very easy for them to just turn around and invade Haiti and get an easy victory, the one you talked about earlier?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose that's a possibility, but I think, you know, I think invading a country like Haiti would, first of all, cause a huge immigration from Haiti to the U.S., which seems to me the Trump administration would not want. I think the optics would be bad to attack a country of mostly, black-skinned people. I don't see that as realistic either, that they're actually going to do that. Again, I see this as more of flexing American power rather than actually exercising it against the people. Certainly, attacking Haiti would be, I suppose, easier in the sense that I think their capacity to defend themselves with arms is probably less. But again, what are you going to do? You're going to go into urban areas and start killing people? Again, you'd have to kill thousands of people. I'm not saying they're not willing to do that, but I think it would not go down well.
Well, it's very different, Dan, because they've got Eric Prince on the ground there, right, with 200 mercenaries who are their advance team. They're already directing the panache and funding at the Haitian police. They've already got the so-called MSS troops led by Kenya on the ground. They're already having that battle with the so-called gangs in Haiti, right? And so it's not implausible, I think, that might be an easier target because they really got the forces lined up to do it from what we've been observing on the ground in Haiti.
Well, that may be true, but I think they like to do it that way in the way you're saying, which is more of a stealth way. The truth is that's not being seen, you know, by most Americans. Don't know that war is happening because it is a covert war, right? To actually send gunships in to attack and Marines to attack, that would be a very overt, you know, military invasion, which, again, I'm not sure... would go over well with the American people or certainly with the rest of the Caribbean and Latin America. So I'm not ruling out that possibility, but there's a lot of risks for Trump in doing that.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm going to have you back this week later, and we're going to talk more about these accusations of Maduro collaborating with drug cartels in Venezuela. Dan Kovalik, thank you for joining us today again on Flashpoints for Pacifica Radio.
Thank you.
That does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kboo.portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification.